Chapter 23. Byron. The 19th century, in comparison with the present age, appears rational, progressive, and satisfied. Yet the opposite qualities of our time were possessed by many of the most remarkable men during the epoch of liberal optimism. When we consider men, not as artists or discoverers, not as sympathetic or antipathetic to our own tastes, but as forces, as causes of change in the social structure, in judgments of value or in intellectual outlook, we find that the course of events in recent times has necessitated much readjustment in our estimates, making some men less important than they had seemed, and others more so. Among those whose importance is greater than it seemed, Byron deserves a high place. On the continent, such a view would not appear surprising, but in the English-speaking world it may be thought strange. It was on the continent that Byron was influential, and it is not in England that his spiritual progeny is to be sought. To most of us his verse seems often poor, and his sentiment often tawdry, but abroad his way of feeling and his outlook on life were transmitted and developed and transmuted until they became so widespread as to be factors in great events. The aristocratic rebel, of whom Byron was in his day the exemplar, is a very different type from the leader of a peasant or proletarian revolt. Those who are hungry have no need of an elaborate philosophy to stimulate or excuse discontent, and anything of the kind appears to them merely an amusement of the idle rich. They want what others have, not some intangible and metaphysical good. Though they may preach Christian love, as the medieval communist rebels did, their real reasons for doing so are very simple. That the lack of it in the rich and powerful causes the sufferings of the poor, and that the presence of it among comrades in revolt is thought essential to success. But experience of the struggle leads to a despair of the power of love, leaving naked hate as the driving force. A rebel of this type, if, like Marx, he invents a philosophy, invents one solely designed to demonstrate the ultimate victory of his party, not one concerned with values. His values remain primitive. The good is enough to eat, and the rest is talk. No hungry man is likely to think otherwise. The aristocratic rebel, since he has enough to eat, must have other causes of discontent. I do not include among rebels the mere leaders of factions temporarily out of power. I include only men whose philosophy requires some greater change than their own personal success. It may be that love of power is the underground source of their discontent, but in their conscious thought there is criticism of the government of the world, which, when it goes deep enough, takes the form of titanic cosmic self-assertion, or, in those who retain some superstition, of Satanism. Both are to be found in Byron. Both, largely through men whom he influenced, became common in large sections of society which could hardly be deemed aristocratic. The aristocratic philosophy of rebellion, growing, developing, and changing as it approached maturity, has inspired a long series of revolutionary movements, from the Carbonari after the fall of Napoleon to Hitler's coup in 1933. And at each stage it has inspired a corresponding manner of thought and feeling among intellectuals and artists. It's obvious that an aristocrat does not become a rebel unless his temperament and circumstances are in some way peculiar. Byron's circumstances were very peculiar. His earliest recollections were of his parents' quarrels. His mother was a woman whom he feared for her cruelty and despised for her vulgarity. His nurse combined wickedness with the strictest Calvinist theology. His lameness filled him with shame and prevented him from being one of the herd at school. At 10 years old, after living in poverty, he suddenly found himself a lord and the owner of Newstead. His great-uncle, the wicked lord, from whom he inherited, had killed a man in a duel 33 years ago and been ostracized by his neighbours ever since. The Byrons had been a lawless family, and the Gordons, his mother's ancestors, even more so. After the squalor of a back street in Aberdeen, The boy naturally rejoiced in his title and his abbey, and was willing to take on the character of his ancestors in gratitude for their lands. And if, in recent years, their bellicosity had led them into trouble, he learnt that in former centuries it had brought them renown. One of his earliest poems, On Leaving Newstead Abbey, relates his emotions at this time, which are of admiration for his ancestors who fought in the Crusades, at Crecy and at Marston Moor. He ends with the pious resolve, "Like you will he live, or like you will he perish. When decayed, may he mingle his dust with your own." This is not the mood of a rebel, but it suggests Childe Harold, the modern peer who imitates medieval barons. As an undergraduate, when for the first time he had an income of his own, he wrote that he felt as independent as a German prince who coins his own cash, or a Cherokee chief who coins no cash at all but enjoys what is more precious, liberty. I speak in raptures of that goddess because my amiable mamma was so despotic. He wrote in later life much noble verse in praise of freedom, but it must be understood that the freedom he praised was that of a German prince or a Cherokee chief, not the inferior sort that might conceivably be enjoyed by ordinary mortals. In spite of his lineage and his title, his aristocratic relations fought shy of him, and he was made to feel himself socially not of their society. His mother was intensely disliked, and he was looked on with suspicion. He knew that she was vulgar, and darkly feared a similar defect in himself. Hence arose that peculiar blend of snobbery and rebellion that characterized him. If he could not be a gentleman in the modern style, he would be a bold baron in the style of his crusading ancestors, or perhaps in the more ferocious but even more romantic style of the Ghibelline chiefs, cursed of god and man as they trampled their way to splendid downfall. Medieval romances and histories were his etiquette books. He sinned like the Hohenstaufen, and, like the Crusaders, he died fighting the Muslim. His shyness and sense of friendlessness made him look for comfort in love affairs, but as he was unconsciously seeking a mother rather than a mistress, all disappointed him, except Augusta. Calvinism, which he never shook off, to Shelley in 1816 he described himself as Methodist, Calvinist, Augustinian, made him feel that his manner of life was wicked. But wickedness, he told himself, was a hereditary curse in his blood, an evil fate to which he was predestined by the Almighty. If that were indeed the case, since he must be remarkable, he would be remarkable as a sinner, and would dare transgressions beyond the courage of the fashionable libertines whom he wished to despise. He loved Augusta genuinely because she was of his blood, of the Ishmaelite race of the Byrons, and also, more simply, because she had an elder sister's kindly care for his daily welfare. But this was not all that she had to offer him. Through her simplicity and her obliging good nature, she became the means of providing him with the most delicious self-congratulatory remorse. He could feel himself the equal of the greatest sinners, the peer of Manfred, of Cain, almost of Satan himself. The Calvinist, the aristocrat, and the rebel were all equally satisfied. And so was the romantic lover, whose heart was broken by the loss of the only earthly being still capable of rousing in it the gentler emotions of pity and love. Byron, though he felt himself the equal of Satan, never quite ventured to put himself in the place of God. This next step in the growth of pride was taken by Nietzsche, who says, "If there were gods, how could I endure it to be not God? Therefore, there are no gods." Observe the suppressed premise of this reasoning. Whatever humbles my pride is to be judged false. Nietzsche, like Byron, and even to a greater degree, had a pious upbringing, but having a better intellect, he found a better escape than Satanism. He remained, however, very sympathetic to Byron. He says, The tragedy is that we cannot believe the dogmas of religion and metaphysics if we have the strict methods of truth in heart and head. But, on the other hand, we have become, through the development of humanity, so tenderly, sensitively suffering that we need the highest kind of means of salvation and consolation. Whence arises the danger that man may bleed to death through the truth that he recognizes. Byron expresses this in immortal lines. Sorrow is knowledge. They who know the most must mourn the deepest o'er the fatal truth. The tree of knowledge is not that of life. Sometimes, though rarely, Byron approaches more nearly to Nietzsche's point of view. But in general, Byron's ethical theory, as opposed to his practice, remains strictly conventional. The great man, to Nietzsche, is godlike. To Byron, usually, a titan at war with himself. Sometimes, however, he portrays a sage not unlike Zarathustra, the corsair in his dealings with his followers. Still sways their souls with that commanding art that dazzles, leads yet chills the vulgar heart. And this same hero hated man too much to feel remorse. A footnote assures us that the corsair is true to human nature, since similar traits were exhibited by Genseric, king of the Vandals, by Ezzelino, the Ghibelline tyrant, and by a certain Louisiana pirate. Byron was not obliged to confine himself to the Levant and the Middle Ages in his search for heroes, since it was not difficult to invest Napoleon with a romantic mantle. The influence of Napoleon on the imagination of 19th-century Europe was very profound. He inspired Clausewitz, Stendhal, Heine, the thought of Fichte and Nietzsche, and the acts of Italian patriots. His ghost stalks through the age, the only force which is strong enough to stand up against industrialism and commerce, pouring scorn on pacifism and shopkeeping. Tolstoy's War and Peace is an attempt to exorcise the ghost, but a vain one, for the spectre has never been more powerful than at the present day. During the Hundred Days, Byron proclaimed his wish for Napoleon's victory, and when he heard of Waterloo, he said, "I'm damn sorry for it." Only once, for a moment, did he turn against his hero. In 1814, when, so he thought, suicide would have been more seemly than abdication. At this moment he sought consolation in the virtue of Washington, but the return from Elba made this effort no longer necessary. In France, when Byron died, it was remarked in many newspapers that the two greatest men of the century, Napoleon and Byron, had disappeared almost at the same time. Carlyle, who at the time considered Byron the noblest spirit in Europe, and felt as if he had lost a brother, came afterwards to prefer Goethe, but still coupled Byron with Napoleon. For your nobler minds, the publishing of some such work of art in one or the other dialect becomes almost a necessity. For what is it properly but an altercation with the devil before you begin honestly fighting him? Your Byron publishes his Sorrows of Lord George in verse and in prose, and copiously otherwise. Your Bonaparte presents his Sorrows of Napoleon opera in an all too stupendous style, with music of cannon volleys and murder shrieks of a world. His stage lights are the fires of conflagration. His rhyme and recitative are the tramp of embattled hosts and the sound of falling cities. It is true that, three chapters further on, he gives the emphatic command, "Close thy Byron, open thy Goethe." But Byron was in his blood, whereas Goethe remained an aspiration. To Carlyle, Goethe and Byron were antitheses. To Alfred de Musset, they were accomplices in the wicked work of instilling the poison of melancholy into the cheerful Gallic soul. Most young Frenchmen of that age knew Goethe, it seems, only through the Sorrows of Werther, and not at all as the Olympian. Musset blamed Byron for not being consoled by the Adriatic and Countess Guiccioli. Wrongly, for after he knew her he wrote no more Manfreds. But Don Juan was as little read in France as Goethe's more cheerful poetry. In spite of Musset, most French poets ever since have found Byronic unhappiness the best material for their verses. To Musset, it was only after Napoleon that Byron and Goethe were the greatest geniuses of the century. Born in 1810, Musset was one of the generation whom he describes as conçu entre deux batailles, in a lyrical description of the glories and disasters of the empire. In Germany, feeling about Napoleon was more divided. There were those who, like Heine, saw him as the mighty missionary of liberalism, the destroyer of serfdom, the enemy of legitimacy, the man who made hereditary princelings tremble. There were others who saw him as Antichrist, the would-be destroyer of the noble German nation, the immoralist who had proved once for all that Teutonic virtue can only be preserved by unquenchable hatred of France. Bismarck effected a synthesis. Napoleon remained Antichrist, but an Antichrist to be imitated, not merely to be abhorred. Nietzsche, who accepted the compromise, remarked with ghoulish joy that the classical age of war is coming, and that we owe this boon not to the French Revolution, but to Napoleon. And in this way, nationalism, Satanism, and hero worship, the legacy of Byron, became part of the complex soul of Germany. Byron is not gentle, but violent like a thunderstorm. What he says of Rousseau is applicable to himself. Rousseau was, he says, "he who threw enchantment over passion, and from woe wrung overwhelming eloquence. Yet he knew how to make madness beautiful, and cast o'er erring deeds and thoughts a heavenly hue." But there is a profound difference between the two men. Rousseau is pathetic. Byron is fierce. Rousseau's timidity is obvious. Byron's is concealed. Rousseau admires virtue, provided it is simple, while Byron admires sin, provided it is elemental. The difference, though it is only that between two stages in the revolt of unsocial instincts, is important, and shows the direction in which the movement is developing. Byron's romanticism, it must be confessed, was only half sincere. At times he would say that Pope's poetry was better than his own, but this judgment also was probably only what he thought in certain moods. The world insisted on simplifying him, and omitting the element of pose in his cosmic despair, and professed contempt for mankind. Like many other prominent men, he was more important as a myth than as he really was. As a myth, his importance, especially on the continent, was enormous.